like for a lot of us who don't create, it's like if you want to go for a run and don't go running for like 2 weeks, you know, it's like that same like pent up feeling that you like need to get out on paper.
Yeah,
and
those
need to
are
create.
Our people on this show.
Yeah. A lot of runners out there.
Yeah, but this is a running podcast.
This is a
welcome to the Run Grind podcast.
Yes, sponsored by New Balance. Start off by talking about the truth. We'll start off with like a small subject that's probably easy to cover in the first few minutes.
42.
Like, are you saying like meaning of life, sort of one of those easy ones?
Well, yeah, something like that. Because I know, you know, I've listened to, I think, all of your guys' podcasts so far and really enjoyed them. And I'm trying to figure out if this is like a group therapy session for artists, you know,
it would be if someone in the room knew what they were talking about.
It's like it's like a pseudo intellectual coffee shop banter.
It's mostly banter. Is like,
it's basically my excuse to not be putting my own kid to sleep like once a week.
Although you only have pseudo intellectual conversations with him on death.
Yeah,
robbing you of things.
But I feel like truth is a good place to start because it can apply to like the work that you guys create. It can apply to, you know, we're talking about this podcast, and you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about the future and technology and how that relates to right now. And we spend a lot of time thinking about politics and like we can't escape the headlines.
Yeah.
And what's fake and what's true and truth isn't truth and all that stuff. And, you know, in my business, I do a lot with technology, and, you know, there's a lot of technology that's going to distort truth even more than, you know, how we think it's being distorted today. Not just what you see, but, you know, videos can be almost completely generated. You know, I could take a video of Marshall talking here in this room, put Tun's face on your face, and then take Dina's words and put them into your mouth and make it look hyper-realistic.
You know what? If you had the editing skill for that, that would be amazing. Right now, we can barely cut my stuttering out.
Isn't that the beast who guards hell in Greek mythology?
The compilation of the three of us?
I'll guard hell with you guys any day.
Changing people's voices, and then, well, that'll be the next thing. I think right now is the facial recognition.
We don't even have to go as far as that. It's a kind of, there's like social media where everyone basically curates their life and presents it in a way that basically has nothing to do with, you know, their.
Well, yeah, for sure. But it's where we're at now. Like, right. Do you see this sort of Trump phenomenon being something of what Dina was talking about? Like, an amalgamation of 10 years of reality TV and the rise of social media and all that stuff. You get figures like that up in the forefront, you know, very, very technology based futuristic ideas.
Yeah. So, we're working on this project with a hospital in the Bronx, and they're doing a lot with virtual reality, but I think more interestingly, augmented reality.
Nice.
And we were meeting with a programmer, developer down in the, you know, he's in a basement in the East Village. It's totally like a Skunk Works project. And we were talking about, you know, how augmented reality is going to change the way we experience life in general. You know, we have, think of it as almost two intersecting planes. Like right now we're sitting here in the same room actually looking at each other. And that's so old fashioned in 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, today we could pull up a phone and I could point it at, you know, this dartboard and maybe a 3D object appears or a sculpture appears. But that's a device that's kind of secondary to me. It's already absorbed all the phone numbers I used to remember when I was 16.
And directions, right?
And directions.
It's
already absorbing part of our brain.
We know how to get anywhere by ourselves. And if the GPS, you know, goes off in the car that I'm driving, I have no idea where to go.
And you don't have the map in the back of the driver's seat anymore.
But that works under the assumption that wrong turns are not beneficial, right? Like it's a whole weird way of thinking that a wrong turn going down a different street is not the way to live your life. Like, that's out the window. We only want to make right turns, right?
Well, so there's an intersection of these two ideas, which is what we experience and what is a right or a wrong turn. And so one of the technologies we were looking at in this basement is they're now coming out with these basically glasses where that we're all going to be wearing in a few years, where you see through into reality, but you also see into this parallel augmented reality dimension. And in that parallel dimension, you can see anything. You could see something as simple as an advertisement. I could look at Dina and it would, because I don't need to remember who you are anymore, it will recognize your face. It'll tell me what your name is. It'll tell you all of our interactions.
I can't wait for these glasses because I keep forgetting people's names. I'll never have that issue anymore.
Yeah, and our brains will go to mush, but we'll never forget a name again.
It's okay. Well, you look great.
But I'll remember your kid's name, you know, and if you
But
feel...
so where that intersects with truthiness, what we were talking about before, and with kind of GPS navigation is that computers through statistics and big data can determine what are statistically the right choices that you should make through your life. And that could, you know, if I'm walking down the street and I walk by the beer store where I picked up these beers today, you know, instead of me having to remember what both what I like, but also what you guys like, it could give me a statistically significant, you know, beer that Ton has liked historically. That's not like the wow factor. What is both powerful and really scary is if you think about micro targeting. Yeah. So think of like the ads that you're served online, based on what you have liked, where you've shopped. To give you a crazy example, and this will sound like a conspiracy theory, but a friend of mine, his wife is starting a company. She came to talk to me because she wanted to hear about starting Sugarlift and get some advice. And her company is basically making silk scarves like Hermes, but instead of them being more like design oriented, she wanted to work with like street artists, like emerging artists to do the designs. And so she and I, you know, were sitting there having coffee for about an hour, and we must have said Hermes like 20 times. I get home that night and I'm on Instagram and I'm flipping through Hermes ads.
No, yeah, for sure.
You know, literally it's listening to me talk and can micro target me an ad. Okay, now think about, we're talking about deception before we started rolling and truth. If I can manipulate a video that's not real, it's generated, both the voice, the context, the person, and I can micro deliver that to a specific person who needs to hear a specific message to influence their behavior. That's now propaganda, not at the poster level. That's propaganda at the individual level to influence behavior. And, you know, what we've seen lately with like the rise of what's going on in the news, I don't even have to say it, like that's a more blunt propaganda. And it's convincing people to act in really like irrational and I would say immoral ways. But to think of being able to do that on like a micro targeting level is going to be like, is a powerful thing and also like a very scary thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Cause it's like, they control where stuff funnels to.
I mean, so for the record, and I'm not that much of a Luddite, but I actually feel like there will never quite be a replacement for what we're doing right now. And I mean, there's a reason that we invite people here and get them drunk, partially to, you know, open them up. But I feel like as humans, I agree with everything you're saying. Like all of this stuff is getting better and better and more sophisticated and kind of changing some of our,
scarier.
I don't think so. I think people will always fundamentally want what they've always wanted, which is to kind of love, be loved, connect, be connected to.
But you heard of the term hyper-reality? Sorry to cut you off, Dina. No, it's just being stuck in your own sort of bubble. For example, if you're looking at Facebook news, you're only seeing what
people
you want to see.
People who agree with you?
Right. So the more you look at it, the smaller your world gets, and it becomes this weird hyper-reality. So people were surprised that Trump got elected is because they were all stuck in a hyper reality.
There's this article that was fascinating to Wright's point that they were saying teenagers right now, or even young adults, they're statistically more anxious and more depressed by like overwhelming numbers, like that's spiking. And they said what they consider adult activities, what I would say, you're saying what we're doing, the need to drink, talk, whatever, like those are lower. So like kids are less inclined to go out drinking, to have sex, to do any, they're just, even they said in the article, go outside, which is like fascinating. So like there may be a need for this, but it's getting mediated by technology and sort of robbed. Like technology is just saying you have that need, we'll replace it here in your bedroom on a phone.
But I mean, how long is it going to be before? I agree with everyone.
But it's happening.
It's happening. But I feel like simultaneously, like there's got to like the need, like this needs a need to connect, the need to kind of keep doing. Like I guess Luddites will always exist, which is kind of the, you know, even when our AI overlords take over. But by the way, would this be a good time to introduce, right? You know, before we get like even deeper into the meaning of life.
So we have right here, welcome to the Art Grind podcast. Would you call yourself director of Sugarlift Gallery? What is the title?
So I just go with founder.
Founder.
I started it about 4 years ago.
Okay.
One thing I don't use, and I think it's silly, a lot of founders of very small companies will call themselves CEOs. I feel like
Overlord?
Overlord. I feel like CEO gallery. Once you're at 100 employees, maybe overlord when you're at like 10,000.
Once it's happening in space, you can be an overlord.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually, Wright, could you, so one of the reasons that we had Wright on, or we have him here right now, is that we're kind of talking in one of our previous interviews about how terrible, a lot of galleries are, and how terrible they are to work with, and how terrible it is to be an emerging artist. And then we're like, we sound like we're whining. Yeah, I was talking about that. I sound like I'm whining. Like, let's actually have someone who's not like that on.
A good one.
And you were the first person that came to mind. So,
you're like Gandalf.
You're the Gandalf of, you know, of gallery overlords. Could you kind of explain exactly what Sugarlift is? Because it's not a traditional gallery.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. And just for anyone who's listening to this, is the first episode. Dina is full of crap. She, if you go back and listen to her episode, she's going on and on about. So when you guys invited me, I was super excited to be on here, by the way. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
And So I was like, oh, I should do some research. I should listen. You know, first of all, I was like, oh, I didn't know about this podcast. It sounds great. And so I went back and I started listening to some podcasts, and the Dina episode, I like fast forward to a part and you're just like, you're like, yeah, every dealer I've met sucks. If you're an artist, you think getting a gallery is like the be all end all, but then you realize it's the worst thing that's ever happened to you. And I'm like, man, I'm walking into like the wolf's den here.
Bollocks. Okay, so I actually didn't have particularly great luck with galleries for my 20s, but I've worked with two or three kind of in the last few years that I've really liked. So I amend that to most galleries kind of suck, but you don't. And I know we have. I've been working with someone recently who's fantastic, and I can't tell if the gallery system is changing or if there's always kind of good eggs in there. It's just that I didn't meet them in my 20s. I also kind of met the person that I worked with for at least part of my 20s on a Greyhound bus to I think it was a Chinatown bus from New York to Boston, and maybe that should have been a warning sign. So possibly the problem was me choosing rather than, you know, the.
So I'd like to point out that was woman-splaining.
Yeah.
So we finally know what it is.
Yeah, put the gloves on. Okay, make sure my ego is okay, non-threatening. And like, you're like, just answer my question.
So much nicer, right?
Yeah.
Nice to.
Well, does your ego feel better after I woman-splained it?
Definitely. You know, yeah. Very comfortable.
Because that's actually what I'm here for. It's to woman-splain shit that Tana Marshall say.
So another episode I listened to that I really enjoyed was Frank. Frank.
Yeah, Frank Bernarducci.
Bernarducci. Yeah, that was really interesting too, for me, because I'm not like of the art world. I'm not really like in that circle. You know, full disclosure, other than my wife working at Sotheby's and being like a complete rock star there, if you need a Rembrandt, like she's your person. Wow. But other than Calvin, like I'm not steeped in the art world. So okay. Hearing Frank's story about like the game being about selling, you know, $100,000, $150,000 paintings,
yeah,
is like a totally different existence than what I'm trying to carve out with Sugarlift. And so Dina, to answer your question, you know, 10 minutes later, so I started Sugarlift, partially because I've been into visual arts my whole life, and you know, that intersected with wanting to run my own business. You know, I wanted to wait until there was an opportunity to put a roof over my head and be able to do those things at the same time. And I saw this very kind of obvious disparity, in that there are so many young, talented artists creating great work. On the other side, so many new customers, new collectors. And, you know, as the audience widens and broadens in terms of people who are, you know, somewhat interested in like higher level pseudo-intellectual, you know, visual arts, that the traditional system of which Frank is a part and of which, you know, my wife Calvin at Sotheby's is a part wasn't kind of naturally catering to that new audience. It had, you know, Frank,
like a young collector base. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, younger. Yeah. I'm going to sound like a pseudo economist now. And that's the last time I'll say pseudo, because I know you guys are going to throw me out of this room.
Your phone will start advertising. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I did study economics. So there are two important trends here. One is just pure demographics. Around the world, there are more people. There are more wealthy people. Mm-hmm. There are thousands of billionaires around the world. That's not our audience, but there are also millions of millionaires just here in the States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 100 years ago, to be a millionaire meant you were one of the richest people in the world. And, you know, of course, you know, with inflation, all that, but also with wealth creation, there are way more people that have a lot more disposable income than they can spend on basically necessary goods. Mm-hmm. So think about that trend. In life, you know, the first thing you need is you've got to put clothes on your back, you've got to put a roof over your head and food in your belly. You know, once you get beyond that, maybe you're looking at some higher level things like some experiences, travel. Then you get into kind of like luxury good land. Now you don't just need a watch to tell you what time it is, but you need a watch that you feel good about and that your friends, you know, shows your friends that you're rich and sophisticated.
Yeah.
Art is one of those higher level things that, now as an artist, that's a completely different conversation. I think great artists create because they need to, but from a consumer standpoint, you start to get interested in art because you've almost run out of other things. And in life, it becomes this other rabbit hole you can go down. You know, you might collect because it's a status symbol. You might collect because it's tied to like historical references. You might collect because you get to know the artists and it kind of reminds you of so many other things in life, almost like reading, you know, good poetry. It kind of has this like echo effect.
Yeah, that there is like kind of a social component to the collectors I have, like some consistent ones are like, you're sort of invited into their world, you know? It's like a whole social thing. Like, you go to dinner with them, go to parties. Like, that seems at a pretty big draw for some of these people, just sort of have that around their parties.
So have a pet artist?
That's
so if you think of, like, you know, an economist would look at, like, market size. So the number of people that are now spending money on luxury things or non-necessary goods is like off the chart in the last 30 years.
Thanks to Amazon.
Even 30 years.
Thanks to Amazon and basically thanks to this like golden age in which we live.
So by the way, before you go on, you said your background was economics. So before starting Sugarlift 4 years ago, what was your day job? You know, what was your job before this?
Yeah. So when I studied at UVA in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I met my wife, Calvine. You know, I entered UVA being really interested in visual arts, but I was there on my old man's scholarship, and I'm very thankful for that. And he told me, you know, I should study something that'll help me get a job after school. And I think he was referencing visual arts at the same time. So I studied economics and finance, and you know, long story short, met Calvin, who's from Rye, New York. Originally, we came up to New York. It was only my second time coming up to see the Jean-Claude Cousteau gates in Central Park.
Central Park, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw those.
It was awesome and a great excuse to come to New York. I was taking an art history class since 1945 in order to get the studio art major. And we went to MoMA and I saw the, you know, Rauschenberg bed, and I saw the, you know, Jackson Pollock's and Jasper Johns's, things that I'd only seen in like a textbook before, and realized that New York was going to be the place I wanted to move to after school.
Because of the art here.
Yeah. I mean, to even go back before that, you know, to get on the... Just to go back to my childhood, I grew up in Naples, Florida.
Okay.
Which is unusual. A lot of people, you know, have grandparents who live there, and people move there to retire. And not complaining, because I had a great childhood, and being a mile from the beach and having 75 degree Januarys isn't something to complain about. But it was kind of lacking in culture. I think the closest thing they had was like a Philharmonic, but they really had nothing in terms of like a visual arts scene. So for me growing up and being really into like drawing and naturally like using that part of my brain, you know, it was, we were kind of, I was like a barbarian who was like into art, but really had no formal connection to art history or anything contemporary, you know. For a young person, it's easy to get stuck there, because part of my philosophy in life is you need to be uncomfortable and you need to suffer a little bit in order to progress.
We've had arguments about this.
Isn't that why we're all here? I mean, we're not in New York to be comfortable,
definitely.
Right?
It's a hard thing to, when you finally realize that is, we're talking about the truth. The truth is that in order to achieve and progress, you need to suffer. Uh-huh. It's a hard thing to swallow, because you realize that you want to progress over your whole life. Which means, you know,
you need to be constantly suffering.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the life you want to live. At the same time, you also picture yourself on a lounge chair in Naples, sipping on a cold Corona and watching the sunset.
There's different degrees of suffering, though,
but
right?
You know what? I bet you don't, though. I bet you wouldn't do that even like if you had the chance.
No, but it is nice. If my parents ever listen to this podcast, thank you for still being there, because I love I love visiting you multiple times a year. Yeah.
They have the lounge chair ready for you.
Yeah. So to tie back to, okay, so what's the whole point of this? It's partially demographics, and there are a lot of, you know, let's be optimistic. I feel like optimism on this podcast is only a smaller slice of the pie.
I try to fight it.
For artists who are creating, be optimistic, because there are a lot more people who are achieving that level of, I've already bought six 60-inch flat screen TVs and they're all the latest model. Now what should I buy? Oh, I think Marshall's paintings are really awesome. Let me meet him, learn more about them. It's opening up to a new audience. The other... Uh-huh. Major trend that is going on and has been going on for the last thousands of years is like the cliched term of like democratization, not of art, because that's usually used in the context of like putting art online, but the democratization of culture in general. So if you think about like that level of access to culture, if you go back 2000 years, you know, you're talking about like kings and pharaohs. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that they could have music because they'd have like a band come and play for them, and they'd have art because they could commission artists and artisans to come and create statues and reliefs and paintings. And if you draw a very long line, you know, and it's not a straight line, it's more like it's accelerating like so many things are in our, you know, in our lives. But you go back, you know, to like, we're talking about, you know, Calvin and old master paintings, like those weren't commissioned by kings. Those paintings were commissioned by like rich merchants. Mm-hmm. And they weren't portraits of the pharaoh god, sun god. They were portraits of the rich and successful humanist mercantile, you know, patriarch.
They like went secular around like the Renaissance, right?
Secular and also less uber wealthy.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And more in number.
Uh-huh.
So that's the trend, is that it's becoming more democratized, in that now you go, you know, from there to, there are tons, you know, a millionaire collecting a Jeff Koons sculpture. Like, you know, there's probably a million that we don't even know of and don't even really care to, because it's becoming a lot more.
Oh, yeah, because Jeff Koons can make an infinite amount of sculptures because, you know, he's got other people doing it for him. And there's a lot more millionaires to buy them. So you're right. We probably don't know where a lot of those pink balloon dogs
end up.
But
with that, it's, you know, not just, I think it's actually happening more in other forms of culture than visual arts so far. You know, if you think about, you know, in food, like 40 years ago in New York, if you went out to a nice dinner, it would be like a white tablecloth French restaurant or an Italian restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can go to like a David Chang, Momofuku, you know, get a, if you wanted to spend $8 and get like a, you know, a steamed pork bun, that is, it's kind of like high and low art in food that's accessible. And now there's a whole new audience of people who are like foodies, right? Yeah. That's like even a cliched term now.
You're right. You're right. I actually do feel like, I mean, so we've probably talked here about how much social media is a problem way too much. But I feel like Instagram specifically has actually created a whole new bunch of like people who like art. And some of them like, you know, unicorn art, you know, which is, you know, and like photorealistic eye drawings, which is a lot of what happens on Instagram. But I feel like there's a lot more people now that would kind of like the kind of stuff that we like, that we consider good art, than there ever has been before.
But I'm kind of like, I don't know, I'm feeling this conversation go full circle from like talking about the rise of new digital technologies, advertising to you specifically, but then how that does sort of divert a lot of things into one channel. You know, all of a sudden you're getting Hermes things and you're not going to be hearing about the other stuff. And I think with art too, like Instagram has a lot of censorship and filters on it, so you're getting a certain type. And then like the collectors you were talking about, the millionaire collectors, it seems like a lot of what they want to do by necessity is, like you said, a watch, like show some sort of status, show some class, show some taste. And that's a very specific type of content that seems ready-made for the Damien Hirst dots or the Jeff Koons balloon dog, that just sort of was like, hey, this guy knows what he's doing. He knows his way around a museum, and it's not offending anyone. This isn't reminding, say, like, I one of my artist friends, I was painting a painting. He's like, what are you doing? Like, no one wants to be reminded of the atrocities they're committing on their wall. You know what I'm saying? Like, if it's a big, say, you know, whatever, the guy who runs Dow Chemicals doesn't want to buy a painting with pollution in it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's better to just show dots or whatever, a simple draw, right?
I think there's like a maturing that happens both like as a generation on Instagram. Like, Instagram might be a foot in the door in terms of knowing that art is now something you can experience, or just visual language and context is something you can experience outside of an art gallery, I think is really important.
Yeah.
But, you know, also just in terms of a maturing of collectors, of individual collectors, I think, you know, the first step into thinking you can collect art is basically, it's usually two paths. It's one, I like this because, you know, it's big and splashy and has colors that do fun things to my brain and looks good over my couch.
Right.
And two, it's I want status. And I know that those colorful dots are some artists I've heard of, you know, right. It's like Damien something. Uh-huh. And this other guy I know who seems to know what he's talking about with art, he's got one of those. So then the law of transitivity, I want a Damien Hirst.
Yeah, for sure.
You know,
yeah.
And so I think that's like the first step into collecting. But I think that there's a really interesting spectrum that you go down, which is like, okay, that might be the first way in, but the more curious you are and the more you want to learn about, like, oh, that piece of art isn't just, it's not just paint on canvas, you know, it is an artist, it's a person behind the piece.
What sort of collectors are you running into, and do you see something that I would, you know, like Dina's talking about, that feels like white noise on a canvas, just something, the macaroni and cheese of paintings. Like, do you see it as sustenance for people? Are people getting a thrill off of something that benign, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, you have to kind of couch everything in the art space as, you know, what drives people, is very personal and very subjective.
Right.
So something that could be very benign to the four of us could be extremely inspirational to someone else. That said, you can draw, I think you can draw some kind of like broader strokes. And I'd say that, you know, in our space, I haven't mentioned this yet, but so at Sugarlift, we're really focusing on like newer art, like emerging art collectors, people who are buying their first piece or have a handful of works or are kind of catching the bug and want to discover more about what I love about the visual arts. And it's everything behind it, right? Like the artists, the process, let's get geeky about the materials. Uh-huh. Let's think about the art historical context and how, like, Marshall, the symbolism in your pieces relates, you know, to the video I saw at the Whitney, but also just to like politics of the moment.
Right.
So because we focus on new art collectors, a lot of people are starting in that first step of, I want something that visually is appealing and will look great where I live. Or they want something that they think they want something that might be more of like a status symbol, like a Damien Hirst type thing. And what I see is, as my role for the collector, is that I want to push as many people down that spectrum or down that gradient of like, okay, can you get the first, maybe easier piece? You know, maybe it's a bigger, splashier, abstract, colorful piece that's more kind of accessible. And can I hook you so that then you keep asking questions? Maybe you want to go on a studio visit. Maybe you get into work that might be more challenging on the surface, but when you really understand like the artist, when you get into the artist and their process and their philosophy, I think the more you collect, the more challenging work you can get into. Mm. You know, that like just that idea alone creates a dilemma for artists, because there's this like weird selection bias in the art market. And as a prior artist and as someone who talks and works with artists a lot, I see this problem all the time. And I think the best artists are creating work that they need to create. Not that they're like creating because that's going to sell or because that's where the market is or because that's what their dealer wants them to make. But they have this like drive. They have this like pent up pressure that if they don't get that idea out, they're just not going to sleep well. They're not going to feel good about themselves. Yeah. Like for a lot of us who don't create, it's like if you want to go for a run and don't go running for like 2 weeks, you know, it's like that same like pent up feeling that you like need to get out on paper and you need to create.
Yeah, those are our people on this show.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of runners out there.
Yeah, this is a running podcast. This is welcome to the Run Grind podcast.
Yes. Sponsored by New Balance.
Now my iPhone's going to give me New Balance.
So the challenge for that is like, okay, you know, let's take 100 artists as a sample. Like 80% of those are creating art that they want to create that isn't necessarily what that new audience is into. It's maybe a little bit more challenging. It's it's maybe, you know, figurative work that's not like a commission isn't as saleable in the under $10,000 space as like a big abstract or more neutral color field type painting.
Right.
So how do those artists, how do they sustain themselves and keep growing and keep evolving if they're creating work that
ramen noodles.
Yay.
Oh, and they work for other artists.
Commissions of pets. You know, that's been a big one. A big one as far as sustaining.
Wait tables, bartenders. What else? Airbnb, the place.
That's interesting. I think speaking like for myself, I'm someone who creates to my mind. Certainly, really, it's difficult art. It's like really personal. It's a little neurotic. Like it looks more singular. And I wonder, like, when you look at someone like that, are you like, boy, you know, kind of cool, but really tough sell, you know, is that what's going through your head? You know?
Well, I mean, so to relive, seeing your work in this room, when I walked in out of an extremely hot August day here in New York, and you know, had to hit the men's room pretty quickly. So I kind of rushed in a hurry and I said, "Hey guys, what's up? You got to hit the head, be right back." And then I kind of pulled like a Wile E. Coyote by one of your paintings. Cause it's not, you know, it's not decor. It's like a, you know, it's like a lucid dream that you need to like unpack.
Right. Yeah, right.
So for anyone who doesn't know Marshall's work, it's really bizarre.
Yeah,
really bizarre. Is that the best kind of like compulsive?
I think so. Yeah,
you know, beautiful at times, but kind of is a first.
Maybe aggressively bizarre.
Aggressively bizarre. Yeah.
Well, I would say like dreamlike to me is a good fit because, you know, looking at your paintings, they have an element of like collaging ideas. Like they don't feel like a mixed media collage. They feel like very like real and believable experiences. But when you focus on the actual subjects and like the context or the landscape and you add everything up, like it's believable, but clearly not a realistic situation.
Right.
Almost like when you are like woken suddenly from a dream that felt very real. But when you think about what you were actually doing, you realize like, how did I believe that even for an instant?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing because I've only wanted to paint sort of exactly what I want to paint. Hope an audience, you know, finds it, but that's never been really the impetus. And it is sort of, I mean, it's not out of my dreams, but they are just like thing out of my life. It's my life story, just telling it in a bizarre way, you know, with a lot of symbolism. And I often want, I mean, like people, they sell, but it's always like, who is buying this stuff? You know, it's kind of weird. And it's like, we're talking about me because the paintings are around, but it is interesting to hear your opinion as a gallery, someone who deals in art, and just knowing that what I'm doing is such a hard sell kind of by design, you know, like, but you don't want to compromise, like you said, you don't want to compromise anything. I don't want to just paint coffee cups or whatever.
I feel like, Ray, I feel like you're more open to, I mean, A, you're pretty open to bizarre, you know, bizarreness in your life. B, in case any of you guys are artists, you know, and have any bizarre ideas, you're one of the few people I've known who, you know, is really open to strange ideas and making them come to life. And I remember there's some point right after we met when we both had like 3 months old kids or something, when I showed up to, you know, the Sugarlift office, and I was like, hey, what if we get like 4,000 artists to come and take over the High Line, and everyone's going to draw. And you didn't even blink an eye. You're like, oh yeah, yeah, let's do it. You know, where do you think we should start? Of course, we can do that. And I feel like you've done that. You've just hosted an event, which I'm assuming Guna came up with, the Guna Park, who's a fantastic artist, which probably started off the same way. It was Guna like, hey, you know, it'd be really amazing, and you were open to that, right? And I feel like I don't know that many other people who run any sort of business that are as open to strange ideas as you are.
Well, I think the thank you, by the way, for that. I do think that there's a huge opportunity to approach visual arts in general from like a really intuitive and very different perspective.
And fun also.
And fun. And
these
I think
events
the,
were actually a lot of fun.
I think the problem is that we've all been conditioned through a million means, and also by looking at the traditional art market, to think about paintings as like a financial asset that has like a tangible value that goes up over time and has like a hot market and speculative value, and like that goes to auctions, and you're not successful if you're not selling $100,000 paintings, if you're an artist or if you're a dealer. And if you're a collector, you want to buy it and flip it, and like that makes you smart and that makes you good. And it's all this bullshit noise that distracts you from why you guys as artists actually create, and why people who enjoy the art actually look at art.
Mm-hmm. How did you start? I think you had a physical look gallery in Bushwick, right?
Yeah. So the you know, it's the truth, going back to the truth. It's not like some BS mythological tale of Sugarlift, but I had this idea that we wanted to be a platform for emerging artists. And the point was to help them be more sustainable in their careers, with the idea that the saddest thing that can happen is a talented artist that is painting at night and waiting tables, and life gets complicated, and they just say, I give up. I'm just going to work a desk job. I'm mm-hmm. just going to do something that I don't really want to do, but I need the money. And they give up creating. And if you go, you know, if you walk into the Met, and if you walk into any artists who have, you know, died and gone into art heaven, like they've all had, all the important ones have retrospectives. And you look at the evolution of their careers. And, you know, for a lot of artists like, you know, Giacometti, that's up right now in the Guggenheim, that's amazing. I even really only knew his later work. You know, the earlier stuff's kind of interesting, but, you know, the new stuff, unlike Bruce Springsteen, was actually the good stuff, you know? Mm. And I don't know the circumstances of how he funded his evolution, his practice, but if that got cut short, we wouldn't have Giacometti, you know? And when I think about artists of our generation, like the saddest thing to happen would be if someone just gave up for financial reasons, stopped creating, and then we lost out on what they would have created otherwise.
It happens all the time. Like I think about the people I was in school with. There's, you know, out of all these people, there's very few actually doing it, you know, at this point.
I haven't painted for like months because I'm taking a hiatus just to figure out how to make some money so I can do this next year. So that's my approach.
The whole concept was like, okay, can we start a business that somehow helps out in a little way, even if just in a little way, hopefully in a material way, but can we help out artists that we think are deserving and should have, you know, a lifetime of creation? And 4 years ago when we started, I didn't know it would evolve to where it is now as kind of a service and using technology and who our audience was going to be. But I knew that directionally, in terms of supporting the artist community by finding them new clients, was the way we wanted to go. And the most intuitive way to do that was to just rent a space. And we had shows, you know, we had a space. Nice. We, you know, started going around to studios and meeting artists. And the thing we realized was that it was super fun. And we were doing, I think, cool shows, but none of our clients were coming to the openings in like East Williamsburg on like a Thursday or a Saturday,
right?
You know, so all of our business and all of our sales were coming through not really online, but really from clients from Manhattan that were working with us to discover the artists. About a year and a half into Sugarlift, we, you know, for a million reasons, decided to move out of the permanent space, work more closely with clients in like an advisory capacity, but force us, and this goes back to being uncomfortable is good. Mm-hmm. One of our conscious decisions of moving out of the space was like, the space is cool. It's awesome to have parties. It's great to have openings. We can use it whenever we want. But if we don't have a space and we know that doing shows is important and creating in-person experience is important, can we solve that problem? Can we come up with other ways to like engage with the art that isn't necessarily in a gallery space? You know, when I get approached with crazy ideas like, can we have a flash mob of artists take over the High Line and all draw together? To me, that's the perfect way both for artists and the community to have fun, meet each other, create. But it's also a cool experience for people who, you know, are one of the 300 something thousand Dina Brodsky fans to come out and actually watch you draw and meet you and see that, you know, before the like hyper realistic, perfect image, like there's a process and there's actually like to see you create is magic. And I want people to experience that.
So, you know what for me was the most magical part of that subway, right? You know, there's a point when we all got off at, you know, some station and drew the models that you brought in who may or may not be working for Sugarlift as well. But I just heard total strangers kind of like, you know, in the back of me looking at all this stuff and being like, this is so cool. And they didn't know who anyone there was. They didn't know that, you know, there's a few of the artists that you invited to host who are actually pretty established. Like they had no idea who you are, who, you know, like I don't know, Guno Park is, but they were just like, this is awesome. And you know, and that's what, like, you know, like, and they just stopped to watch. And for me, that was the magical part. Just, you know, like not even getting to meet the people that whose work you've maybe only seen online. But just having total strangers can realize how much fun drawing can be.
Yeah. I think, you know, when people, the cliched term is like, you know, democratization of art or like art accessibility. And usually when people say that, they're talking about putting images of art online and having a click and buy button. And to me, that's teaches people that art is just an image. And that's the opposite of how, you know, artists think about their work. It's the opposite of how you really like enjoy a piece. So to create experiences where, you know, to tie it back to like David Chang and the pork bun, like the pork bun is as good as food gets, but it's still like kind of lowbrow and immediate. For the drawing event we did on Saturday, the Guno Park and I dreamt up, we decided, you know, let's take over a subway car and draw for an hour or so, and then we'll get out of the subway downtown and we'll have a small gallery space, a pop-up space ready for us. So then we'll just tear the drawings out of our book, put them on the wall, and that'll be the show. And the idea is that art can be like cheese.
Or like pork buns.
Or like pork buns. And Tun's like, where the hell's he going with this one? And by
I
that,
like
I mean,
analogy, though.
Can you mansplain this to me?
Yeah, let me mansplain this. So Dina, so cheese is made out of curds, and you take the curds and you know, you can have like super aged Parmesan that takes a village.
But by the way, I know nothing about cheese, so I yeah.
All right, so Dina, you take the cow and you. So art doesn't always have to be so sophisticated and so finished. Like if you're going to a show at Gagosian, like I want to see something that's approaching art heaven, something that could hang at the MoMA or the Met. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to, you know, the Lower East Side to see drawings made that day, there's something cool about seeing four drawings that Guno did in the last hour. you know, where he's kind of walking the tightrope knowing, like, I don't have time to finish this in my studio. I don't even really have time to think about these. I've just got to create. And there's like an immediacy that translates Guno's hand and his intention in like an unvarnished way that isn't necessarily high art. That's why it's the pork bun. It's like delicious and very Guno.
Guno is a pork bun. Yeah.
So we, Guno, we actually
you just earned a new nickname.
so we did an interview with Guno, which God, we might have to release before releasing the movie, right? We did it on this podcast that you know, that we didn't invite Marshall to, and have since and have since merged into this one.
It's not canon.
They're gonna have to dub you in. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, but I basically I think I met you through a show that he curated back when you had a physical space. So how do you and that show had some phenomenal artists in it. How do you kind of pick the people that you end up representing? You show some awesome people.
Well, so the early shows, the whole approach was like, don't overthink it. How do we make art accessible? Well, let's start with the basics. And so our very first show was a printmaking show, which, you know, was a mistake in hindsight, because I didn't realize at the time to our audience and to most people, a print means a photograph of a painting that's printed out on an Epson printer.
Right, right.
Uh-huh. Whereas to me at the time, a print was this like rich world of all these different mediums, from like etchings to woodblock to lithography to, like, you know, we're drinking all these different styled beers tonight. To me, printmaking is like the craft beer of art, where you can really, like, there, it's like limitless in the different ways that you can create. Mm-hmm. You know, we put together a really great show, and actually for that show, we worked with 12 artists and paired them with 12 basically like master printers to create, to basically commission 12 series of traditional printmaking for that show. So it was a crazy amount of work. Awesome. And a good memory, but commercially a flop. Mm. And that's because we realized very quickly that our market and the people that, you know, it's our responsibility to communicate on the same level and to bring them with us. And you can't do that if you're using a vocabulary that people don't understand. So we, you know, we went on to do more like specific shows. Like, we did one on collage as a medium, something that is very kind of approachable. We did another show on, and this was almost like a reaction to the idea of what is a print. We did a show on digital artwork, but not as reproductions, but using digital artwork as a means of creating something that couldn't have been created before there's like Illustrator and Photoshop and like 3D rendering programs. So it was a way of like saying, you know, when Stieglitz got a hold of the camera, he wasn't using it as like a supplement or like a replacement to like a pen and paper. He was using it as like a new way to create. So we're thinking about like digital technologies in the same way. Dina, the show that you're referencing was called Ballpoint, and we wanted to do, you know, like some of these beers that we have right here are probably like single hop varietal beers.
The show was about beer. That's
all my analogies are alcohol related. But, you know, it's the brewer's way of saying, hey, Mosaic hops taste different from Cascade hops. And I'm going to show you that by brewing a single Mosaic and a single Cascade and let you see the difference. So we did a show on just Ballpoint to say, not everything's a painting. Not everything is a painting or a print or an original or a print.
And like, that was actually one of the best shows that I've ever been in. I mean, seriously, it was such an honor to be showing with the people that were in that. And I think for some of them, it was kind of people whose work I'd maybe followed online for a long time, but it was the first time I'd actually seen it, and it was gorgeous. So
thanks. Yeah, it was a badass show. And there was one, we borrowed two drawings from Forum Gallery for that show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're like slinging art out of Bushwick for like, you know, $500, $250. It's like, we're, you know.
Was borrowing art from Forum horrible? Because
it wasn't horrible, but the.
They might be listening.
The amount, yeah.
Well, you know what? And I
the
feel,
amount
I
we
feel
had
like
to insure
feel,
was
yeah,
like.
Yeah, I feel like they should know that. I feel like they should know
they
that borrow, is it, is it bar, the borrowing art from Forum Gallery is awful to the point where it's not, it's half the time, you better really like the artist.
I forget the name of the woman who I worked with at Forum, but she was lovely.
Is actually,
and the
yeah,
only the only shock about working with them was the sticker shock, because the prices of the work that we borrowed from them were multiple zeros longer than the work we were showing. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. It's just, it's kind of a, again, it, for me, it's like a realization that there's like the traditional art market that's been built a certain way and caters to a certain audience. And I think there's an opportunity for something new.
But do you feel like you're building a community? It seems like all the conversations that you have a theme about enjoying art, sort of ushering people into their an experience where they could enjoy it themselves. I was kind of struck by how you were talking about like art, it isn't a pristine image, it's a process, and that how, and I could imagine you telling that to collectors and things, and then taking art to the street to people on their daily commute, just like it's in front of them, like this stuff is important. Do you see that as sort of a mission statement?
Definitely. I mean, I think that I think the way that I enjoy art and the way that most people enjoy art is directly the piece, and that the piece might, you know, at the first level be visually interesting. Like, let's say it's the composition is in a way that kind of keeps your eye moving and you don't get hung up and it just kind of sings and works. And I think there's like a visual value to a piece. Then I think there's like a contextual value, which is like, oh, this piece is responding to, you know, this piece I saw in MoMA, because it's all connected, and that this artist is clearly being inspired or looking at this other artist. And they're not a derivative, but they're like evolving, and they're like further down the branch on the same, you know, or they're further down the branch on the same tree. I think the other value can be like experiential, you know, the same way that like if you know the lead singer in the band on the Bowery, like other people might think the band's okay, but you like love it because hung out and he's your friend and you like had beers and you had this crazy experience one night, or like you're drinking this wine, because I've got to make the alcohol analogy, and like you've been to the vineyard and you met the person who grew the grapes, and like you can smell the dirt when you drink the wine. Like there's this like contextual value that you personally can bring to the piece. You know, when we're introducing new clients to art, it's never buy this because it's a good investment. Or like buy this because this artist is hot. It can be buy this because you fell in love with it in the first instant and you can't stop thinking about it, even though you don't know that much more about it. But it's usually, let me tell you about this artist. Here's their story, and here's what they believe in, and here's where they came from, and here's why they make this piece.
So, by the way, so you do something that very few galleries do, which is which made me tear up. You were the first gallery that I was working with that did this, where when you would sell art, you would actually like write a letter of introduction between like the artist and the collector. And
yeah, we that do was, that for every which, every collector. Yeah,
that
which,
is unheard of.
Well, it's unheard of now. I mean, so by the way, everyone who's I've ever talked to who's worked with Sugarlyph like loved it. But I think one of the reasons is like, I mean, A, you're not a pretentious douchebag, but and
despite all the wine and cheese.
But you kind of behave.
I'm waiting for Marshall to say the same thing. I'm working on you.
But so you behave like a gallery, kind of like in the idea. You know, I remember a long time ago for some project that me and Tan were doing, we're gathering a bunch of information from artists who are much more established than we are about how a good gallery behaves and versus, you know, how a bad gallery behaves. Mm-hmm. And so we got, you know, like for the bad gallery list, we got, I don't even know, like 18 pages of, you know, ways that a gallery could potentially be awful to an artist. But there was like one or two pages of what a good gallery would do. And we're reading this and we're like, no one does this. Who does this stuff?
Yeah.
But you guys actually do all that stuff. Like you pay on time, you introduce artists to the people who actually like the work because you trust the artist enough not to go behind your back. And because they won't go behind your back because they actually like you because you're, you know, not a douchebag. And, you know, you do all, like you come for studio visits and you actually give some amount of constructive criticism. You're open to, like you're what a gallery should behave like. And pretty much no one actually does.
Well, I think it, you know, just like as an artist, you've got to think about, like, what are my objectives, or like, what am I trying to optimize, which informs like what you create. And for Sugarlift, we started as like a very artist centric gallery. The whole point was to help artists be more sustainable. So given that, it informs like all the actions we take around, you know, if I went back to the early archives in Dropbox, I'd find like a business plan. And there's a page that's like, how are we going to treat artists? Mm. You know, it's like, we're going to like pay them on time, and we're going to like pay them as much as we can while still being in business. And like, we're going to never damage or lose their work. And like, there's bullet points of like, okay, let's think for a long time about like, let's talk to artists and hear what sucks about galleries, and let's not do those things. Mm. And, you know, in just like an artist, you know, practice evolving, like mission number one for our business is to be sustainable so that we can continue to grow and grow in the number of artists that we can support and grow in the number of collectors we can bring into the fold. And it's a very like bootstrap process. It's not going to happen overnight. I hope that I get to do it for the rest of my life.
That's amazing. I don't think any gallery starts with those bullet points at all.
I agree. Yeah,
especially the first part, which is let's make the artist happy. Probably they don't even probably think about it.
I don't think that's on the list. I think that's way under if the artist is a young girl, maybe let's sleep with her. Like, I mean, I feel like I'm sure a lot of
seasoned gallerists are, if they're listening to this, they're thinking like, that's foolhardy. Even if like they
commercially
had, yeah, commercially
possibly,
because it's not necessarily how the art market had been constructed for a long time, and all that's changing. And the major disruptor there, it's not us by any means, the major disruptor is the whole concept of the independent artist, and that exclusive representation by a gallery is no longer the holy grail, and it's no longer the norm.
Right.
Unless you're operating at the very top of the market. If I were an artist, I would give Zwirner, you know, exclusive representation all day, but I wouldn't give some schmo gallery in the Lower East Side or Brooklyn exclusive representation because they can't fully take care of any one artist.
Well, right. I feel like what's different about you guys is that you actually realize that that the system is changing, and you're trying to figure out how it's changing and go with it. Whereas I feel like a lot of the places that I, you know, have talked to or maybe have shown with are trying to fight it and stick to the old system. But I think in the old system, they could support the artists. And, you know, things changed maybe around 2008, 2009 when the last recession hit. I think before that, if you signed a contract with, you know, a gallery, chances are they would sell out your show, and, you know, then you would hide in your studio for the next two years like a troll.
Well, the other thing is that the show would sell out to one or two collectors.
Yeah.
Frank said this too. He said, you've got one or two or a couple collectors that do all of your business.
And what if one of them dies? I mean, seriously, like a lot of the people with this much, you know, like I feel like, you know, people have been collecting for a long time. They're not spring chickens, you know, like what if one out of your four big collectors,
which is why Wright is collecting new young collectors.
We're not going to die.
So this is a whole separate idea. If we can go on a tangent,
please,
which is,
definitely.
I think that I think it's a responsibility of each generation to collect the artists of their generation.
Oh, I love that.
It's a responsibility because artists need the patronage. They need to pay for their studios, and materials are really expensive if you haven't bought paints and other materials before.
I just bought that $60 tube.
Yeah, you're just showing me that. Like Egyptian lead.
Marshall has this tube of Naples yellow that is so gorgeous.
That you can
for
lift
all your art dorks.
You could do your weights with it.
Yeah.
And it's pure lead.
But also, there's a responsibility for us to keep pushing, you know, not to like sound too like over the top, but like it's each generation's responsibility, let's say just within the visual arts, like to keep pushing human consciousness forward. Like we can't keep like if you were anyone this. Could create a Jackson Pollock now, and that's not interesting, even it's exactly the same thing. But when he did it, it was kind of interesting because like action painting was new, and it like expanded all of our minds a little bit and opened up possibilities that they kind of, you know, ran into a number of other like tributary styles.
Well, it's like you said, you're further down the branch of something that already existed earlier. I had a teacher say to me, he's like, that's great. Like it's something I was drawing. And he's like, but you have to sort of like reckon with everything that's come before you.
You have to. Yeah.
And it's like, fuck, like that's a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things that I think what makes a great artist today is, I mean, you have to be rooted in technique.
Uh-huh.
I think that you have to have some kind of classical or technical training, even if you deviate significantly from that.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at like a, you know, a Picasso or like, you know, Dizzy Gillespie, like you learn all the scales before you play all your blue notes.
Yeah. Totally.
And you can't just jump in and start wailing on a trumpet for the first time. That's not art, right?
Mm-hmm. No, a lot of people think it is, though. They think they could just copy a specific style, not knowing.
It's strange because the only, it's art. I feel like art is the only discipline where kind of de-skilling is kind of encouraged, at least right now. Like, I feel like you wouldn't want a de-skilled brain surgeon, you know, taking out your brain tumor, right?
Or like
a de-skilled fireman putting out your fire and being like, well, I didn't have to learn how to do this. It's just kind of intuitive. I'm self-taught, you know?
The hobo next door. Yeah, he knows how to take out fire.
Right. So you're clearly one of us, and we love guys like you. You're for skill. You're a champion of that. I know your roster. They're all
and you're
really...
not and you're not just for skill, right? Because that would
right,
be
for
which,
sure.
because
right.
just skill
it's
is
not
kind
just
of boring.
Dry. But they're like, you know, your roster's a lot of real heavy hitters. And like where do you see art from? You know, you've got a different vantage point. Like, and I hate to say words like what's moving, what's hot, but like what where's
maybe,
it heading?
maybe what's next,
what's
like,
next
like, not not even in art, but like what's next for galleries, like, well, Sugarlift is next, but
actually so you went from a physical place and now you're mainly online, right? So that's like
you guys, they do all these cool pop-up scenes.
They're not
just online.
I think Wright already found the perfect medium of what he wanted to do, right?
Oh man, this is the rapid fire question section of the night. I'm like,
It's actually because I've got this like 9:30 deadline because no one's willing to hang out with. No one's willing to like basically hang out with.
Oh, you got a hard. I didn't know you had a.
But because my husband's away for like a few weeks, so.
I mean, we all see trends, and I think that what's important is that. When you look at the actual, like the individual artist who's creating, are they true to go back to truth? Are they true to what they believe they need to create? Or are they merely like following some kind of trend?
Do you have a test for that? You know how like in Blade Runner, there's a test they run if you're an Android or not.
The replicants.
The replicants.
Yeah.
Can you run one for an actual artist?
Oh, your please. Hand in a box and see if it
and like, dude,
do
you
tell.
Know, just to like, people who listen to this are going to think like, oh, they only talked about like two things. And so to tie it back to like staying uncomfortable.
Yeah.
in this case, it's staying uncomfortable. Not true. It's actually both. But I think the artists that are true are the ones that are staying uncomfortable. And by that, I mean, the artists that I think are truly pioneering are consciously evolving their practice by making sure that they don't settle into a comfortable pattern of doing something that has worked, so they keep doing it. Uh-huh. You know, so for instance, there's a street artist named Ruben 415 who we work with, who's just
awesome he's
dude.
All over the place.
Yeah,
I've seen him everywhere.
Hardworking now. Dude.
Yeah,
great guy. And you know, you could look at two of his paintings that were created a week apart and think that he's kind of found his rhythm and he's doing his thing and it works. But in his process, he intentionally starts every painting different than any painting he started before. Like he won't follow the same steps he's followed before to ensure that, you know, even that those two paintings might look very similar at the end of the day, that over a year or over 5 years, his practice continues to evolve. And I think that differentiates artists that are pioneering and kind of driven by something internal versus artists who are trying to do what's cool or jump on the bandwagon.
That's great.
So you mentioned kind of technology and the fact that you're experimenting with all sorts of different things. Where do you feel like Sugarlift, I'm not sure what the right question is, where you feel like it's going or where do you want it to be? Like, let's say, you know, like in 5 years, in 10 years.
The objective is grow the pie of people who are interested in collecting art. And that's about inspiring people and storytelling and like opening their eyes to the value of living with art. Part of that is like by inspiring that audience, we're getting them to buy or commission more pieces, which puts more money into the pockets of the artists and the art community. Mm-hmm. Like at the highest level, that's what we're trying to do. So with technology, I think that there are interesting ways to reduce the friction of how you make that happen. For instance, we use augmented reality with our clients where I may visit a client who's redecorated their apartment and has invested in this like beautiful space. And they've got like a big wall in their living room and they're well-to-do and they're educated and they're stylish, but they're not going to spend like $150,000 in a Chelsea gallery. They're interested in learning about art, learning about artists. They may want a painting. So I can use technology to go in, you know, understand their style, look through, you know, 15 artists' work, tell stories about that artist. But then now with augmented reality, I can actually put that painting to scale, like in their living room to sort of try on.
That's super cool.
And that's something that you now don't necessarily need to go to like the gallery or his storage space, or like, I still think you should go to the artist studio because that's a whole different experience, but there are ways of looking of kind of like trying on art in your life using technology that never existed before. So we're doing a project with a hospital in the Bronx, and we're completely redesigning like a pediatric oncology unit where they basically treat kids from, you know, 2 to 18 with cancer. And we're designing an immersive space with the architects where, you know, the objective is not just to like hang art on the walls and create a beautiful space, but to create like a positive distraction that will kind of like transport you from like pain to maybe it like inspires creativity or like is, you know, can kind of like take you out of the mundane hospital experience and makes it a little bit less threatening. You know, can we also use art to like help you navigate the space? And so we're using technology to create like an iOS app where the children in the hospital can hold up the iPad to some of the murals and it will like bring the murals to life. Or
that's really cool.
A lot of the the artists involved are Gentleman's Game. Shout out to Brandon and Jason. You guys are awesome. They're creating basically digital collages with a lot of like Bronx related imagery. So we're also in the app going to have something where you hold up and can do like a scavenger hunt where through image recognition, the app will pull out like an image of the Bronx Zoo that you can click on, and then it will like tell you about the Bronx Zoo.
Nice.
Or you could hold up, you know, and like scan a hot air balloon, and like the head doctor of the floor will appear in augmented reality and welcome you to the floor and kind of explain the layout.
That's so good. That's so cool. That's really
so there's ways of like it's
and it doesn't actually do that thing, you know, like back to the beginning of this, like it, I feel like what that does is actually kind of almost making reality more real, but like it doesn't take away the need to connect and the need to be human. It actually just gives people more of a way to do that.
And it, in, I think it integrates the visual arts into your life versus thinking about it purely as this high art form where we have to like be in a white cube and be very snooty to like, it's just something that makes life that much better. It just, it's that accent that makes, you know, that makes it more memorable or you
some
know,
of the museums experience. Are actually using that. The Rubin Museum is actually using some VR or.
So artificial intelligence, we talked about like augmented reality is going to be a huge game changer in just how we experience life.
Yeah.
And artificial intelligence, like I'm clearly not an expert, but within the umbrella of artificial intelligence, the things that are really going to change our lives are within Netflix, it's like, how do we build recommendation engines?
Mm.
So how do I fully understand what Dina Brodsky is into based on like past behavior and like other demographic information.
It's all Harry Potter.
And deliver her, Thrones. Like exactly
yeah,
what
Game,
she
Game
wants.
Game of Thrones.
And that's actually something that we look at Sugarlift too, is like if we're not representing a small stable of eight artists where we're trying to like blow up and like create these like mythical stories and like create speculative value, if we're trying to just find the right artist, like using artificial intelligence to build a recommendation engine to help them discover new art is something that I think, like, if we don't use, we won't exist in X number of years.
Yeah.
The other crazy thing about artificial intelligence is that, you know, a few months ago, like you can feed huge amounts of data into an algorithm and then have the algorithm and basically train the algorithm how something works. Right. So like image recognition, I could feed in a million images of
deep learning
of like a chihuahua. Exactly. Yeah. And like a blueberry muffin and then show it an image and have it tell me which of the two it is. Someone, I don't know the name of the scientist, but they fed in like millions of hours of classical music and then the computer could then compose its own song.
Oh, that's scary.
Here's a reason for artists to be optimistic out of this conversation is that the real application of like artificial intelligence is that it's just going to make our lives way more efficient. And if you think about like our work lives, like pre-industrial revolution, like there was no such thing as leisure time. You know, like wasn't even a concept.
Yeah, yeah.
And the more efficient we get at just like work and life, like the more leisure time we have. And also like with technology, the more wealth we build. So if this is a good thing for us, which I think it will be, I'm sure the machines are going to make me pay for that later.
They'll be.
This is the optimistic version.
Like, do you remember when you said that?
Yeah.
You know?
But 10 years in the basement.
You know, that the more like disposable income and the more time people have to think about higher level things like creativity and like artists who are pushing the envelope. And I think for true artists, that's a good thing. You know, there was this whole movement of people being like be in the present moment and be present and all this stuff. And I always think that like, you know, we're talking about like some animals can be deceptive. And like, if there's anything that truly differentiates us from like other like monkeys, even it's that we can kind of live in these alternate experiences. Like even though the four of us are sitting in the same room, like Marshall's dreaming up his next painting. You know, you're like, I've got to pay attention to what Wright's saying here, but I really, really want to paint this, you know? And like our ability to like envision a future or something new or a different state is, I think, the only thing that is like uniquely ours. Yeah. And it's why we're like sitting in a skyscraper right now. And it's why we're surrounded by amazing artwork. It's actually why we're thinking about like the implications of augmented reality and micro-targeting and how that's going to affect like politics and propaganda in the future. That's what makes us human.
It drives me nuts when people say like live in the moment, because I hate it because the people who truly live like, you know, act like that, the ones that truly act like they're not affected by their past, nor are kind of projecting or worried or hoping for the future. I think they're psychotic. I think they're horrible.
Yeah, when did we start running our lives through like tidy cliches? Like it feels like every wisdom.
I think it was mainly driven by like 90s cereal boxes. Yeah, you know, because you'd be looking for something to read, and on the back of like the Smart cereal or whatever, there'd be like Carpe Diem, and it'd be like a snowboarder like jumping off a cliff. You know.
I'm just gonna take a me day.
Just off the bat, like the people that come to mind who truly act like they're living in the present.
Did you have
anything you particularly wanted to talk about?
Actually, like, let's say you've got like a few thousand people listening to you right now. What would you like them to know about like your gallery or Wright Harvey as a person?
And while you're thinking about that, I do have something to say.
Okay.
Because I was like struck during this conversation how where it's a lot of new ideas and a lot of like reckoning with old ideas. And I think like, I'm really happy that people like you in the art world exist. And I think anyone lucky enough to work with you is pretty fortunate. It seems like I endorse everything you're doing. It seems really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, shucks, guys. This has been a lot of fun. I would say, like, you know, if I had any parting words for everyone who's listening, assuming there are a lot of artists out there too, is that, you know, there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic. You know, if you look at the bigger trends, like it's now our time, and it's, you know, I've got to make another alcohol analogy. Like 20 years ago, there was no such thing as like any beer other than like cheap Pilsner. Right. Uh-huh. It was either like Budweiser or Milwaukee's Best. As people get more into even down to the grain and the types of hops and like the different regional varieties and Belgian beers, like that is all knowledge that will not be undone. Mm-hmm. And I can see every day more people who are interested in the visual arts and want to find a way to connect with it, even if you're creating super challenging work. And maybe there's one person out there who's into it today. Tomorrow there's going to be two. And the next day there's going to be more. And that's never going to be reversed. So create the work that is true to you and that you want to create. Never create the work that someone tells you to make, especially a dealer, or work that you think is more commercial. You know, even if you have to get a side job to make it happen, at the end of your life, you know, hopefully that work will outlive you, and the true work is going to be much more important than something that you felt you needed to make. So I'd say, you know, keep at it. You're doing the right thing. And hopefully, you know, your work will represent us as a generation when we're long gone.
Wow. And that was beautifully said. The best close of an art grind we've had.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wright. Thank you for listening to the Art Grind podcast. Rate and review us on Apple Podcast. Also, we're on Instagram at Art Grind Podcast. You can leave comments on the thread or DM us there. We usually see them. Also, Facebook, we're at Art Grind Podcast. You can leave comments, future questions for our guest and such there. Also, we're on, our website is www.artgrindpodcast.com.
Definitely go there for the beautiful images that we post off the artist. And don't be shy to donate us some money so we could buy some really good booze for the guests.
Thanks, everyone. Bye. Bye.